Wednesday afternoon, bright and sunny here on Michigan Avenue. Frank Sennett will be along a little bit later to talk about some stories that have been in Cranes recently. One of them is about the number of women on corporate boards in Illinois and then comparing that to other states. So we'll talk to him about that. We start, though, with Terry Savage from terrysavage.com. You read her there. You see her on TV and just about everywhere else. And she comes to talk about finance with us on Wednesday afternoons. Terry, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Good to be here with you, Steve.
All right, so President Trump, I don't know if he's celebrating in China or not, but it was a year ago he was elected. And I'm thinking of after it became pretty clear he was going to win, remember the Dow futures just absolutely plummeted.
Initially.
And, yeah, and they've been rocketing up since then. 28.5% the increase since his election. Second, the highest number of a post-election year for the Dow since FDR, I think it was in 1945. That's a big number.
It's a huge number, and not only, of course, I didn't see that coming. But in fact, I was quite worried, to be quite honest.
No one did see it coming, did they?
And I was just about to say, I can't see anybody out there bragging that they were, you know, they said, "Whoa, the minute it appeared Trump is going to win, you should buy stocks." I just don't. Somebody would be taking credit now. I haven't seen any headlines like that, which is about the market. You know, the market climbs a wall of worry, and just when everybody is negative, we always know this in hindsight. When everybody is negative is when you should be buying. And of course, you know, the Baird and Rothschild. I buy sheep and I sell deer. I'm in agriculture.
Right.
You know.
Well, okay. So I was just distracted because the president's talking in China and he said his tax. Well, let's just jump to the tax plan because he just said.
Here we go.
He said his tax accountant told him he'll be a big loser in the Republican tax plan. Now,
the president. Well, we don't believe what he says.
Well, I don't know how that could
possibly be true. I mean,
we
haven't seen his taxes, so we don't know.
The Senate plan.
I'd just like to point that out.
Senate is coming out with its plan maybe a little bit later this week. And, you know, it's going to be different from the House. There was one specific item that they're going to take out that would hurt the House plan. But the CBO just scored the House plan and says it would increase the deficit by $1.7 trillion over the next 10 years.
You're baiting me. So let me ask you a question.
Saying,
I want to ask everybody
story.
Out there this question. This year, this fiscal year, where we're having a relatively good economy and low unemployment and no financial crises and the stock market is up, and things are going, and you know, and they're eliminating waste and stuff in Washington. What do you think the CBO says the deficit is likely to be this year?
I have no idea.
In good times, in the best of times.
I have no idea.
$693 billion.
Okay.
So let's put it this way. We are adding to the national debt, you know, in 2008, 2009, it was well over $1 trillion a year that we spent more than we took in. That was in a crisis. But even now, in the ninth year of an economic recovery, in the best of times, we're adding roughly $700 billion to the deficit without hurting anybody, without changing anything. I mean, this year. So now the CBO says, well, if you pass this tax cut, instead of $700 billion, it'll add an extra trillion. I mean, we're throwing these numbers around like they're very
little. $1.7
trillion. $700 billion. No, they said 1.7.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're in line to be losing another $700 billion next year in deficits of spending more than we take in as a government. So let's just say it does go up to $1.7 trillion. We're on a fast road to debt land. Now, what the CBO says is, we're adding up this side of the ledger and this side of the ledger. I just make this point one more time and we'll move on. This is a static analysis. People really do react to incentives. If you stood in line at the post office, as I just did, and you realize that those people have no incentive to serve you faster or with a smile or in a nicer way, so you stand in line forever. But if you go to a business where people get paid on commission and they're jumping right up there to help you, walk into the AT&T store, as I also did, what can we do to help you today? Oh, yeah, well, wait 1 minute, but here, come right over here. Let me get you started. We don't want to lose a customer. The fact is people respond to incentives. If you cut their taxes, people will make more investments, work harder, and bring in more revenues. It's happened every time under Kennedy and under Reagan.
Put another way.
And under Bill Clinton.
Put another way, the CBO score does not include projections of growth. That's what it
doesn't
does.
Include
it does
the
not.
New
so,
revenues you'd get so if you when assume the economy there's be, grows as a result of tax cuts.
So if you assume that this is going to spur any growth at all, the number would be lower than what they're projecting.
Let me make a better point.
I'm trying to be on your side.
I know you are. Let me make a better
point. Except
for
the post office. I love my post office people. Okay, go ahead.
You're going to walk in there and they're going to love you and spit at me. But here's the thing.
Let's go this afternoon.
Here's the thing. What upsets me most about this tax plan is not about the controversy over tax cuts and whether they'll grow the economy, because we have historic evidence to know that. It's that some very mean-spirited people in Congress are trying to, don't believe in this growth, even though they want to cut taxes. And therefore, they're saying, we're going to cut things like excess medical deductions. We're going to cut the deductibility of student loan interest. They won't have to do that if we have a growing economy. Why not give the economy a chance to grow and produce revenues? Take the leap of faith in the American economy, which has happened under Kennedy, under Reagan, under Clinton, when he cut the capital gains tax rate from 28 to 20%, that the revenues will grow because people will be incented to work more, and you won't have to cut important things like Medicare things and like deductions for health care and so forth. I mean, yeah, there'll have to be some changes, but the mean-spirited changes are totally unnecessary.
I think they're going to sink it. I don't think it's going to happen.
I wonder. I don't know.
I mean, you know, and I wanted, I agree that something needs to happen. I'm all on board. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think that those things, I think you've
the
got deficit
sort
hawks.
Of agreeing with you. We're at Dow 25,567, up 9 points. This is the last few days have been the string of, you know, a roughly no movement in the market. And
I think
if they pull back and say, you know what, we'll start again in January, that could trigger a market decline.
I think
sure.
the last night's election results are going to have a big impact on people. You've already seen a couple Republican congressmen say today, I think it was today, that they're not going to run for re-election. I just think that it's not going. I mean, you've got deficit hawks and the Republicans who aren't going to vote for it. I don't think it's going to happen.
It'll be interesting to see. That's all I can say.
All right, that's Terry Savage.
I want to talk about Obamacare and small business,
okay,
health insurance.
Let's do health
and
insurance
stuff like that.
In a break, but give me 45 seconds, 30 a minute on this Obamacare. It signed up. Last week was the first day to sign up, and the numbers were doubled.
Okay.
We're not spending
that's
money.
That's called desperation.
It's fear, right?
So here's the interesting thing. They've shortened the enrollment period. They've cut back on. They have no advertising saying do this. And on Sundays, the day people are sitting at home to possibly do this, they've taken the website down for quote
maintenance.
Maintenance.
Yeah, right.
That's not a bunch of baloney.
Talk about mean spirited. That's mean.
That's totally mean. I mean, that is so mean spirited. So, but here's what. Some people get Obamacare policies on the exchange for free now because of a real quirk in the law. And other people, like many people in our audience, are finding out that, number one, the premiums have skyrocketed. Number two, the networks have shrunk and that they don't get to stay with their best hospitals. I'm writing a column, the one for next week. We'll talk about what to do if you get squeezed out of the Obamacare market because of prices and because of there's very little. Some places have one, you know, choice.
One
and
choice.
Others have very narrow choices.
A year ago, we talked about this plan for small businesses. It is back and it is significant. We'll kick that around with Terry. Natasha Kurecki writes a great sort of a day book or an email, a digest every morning for Politico. She covers Illinois politics. And it's really one of the ways I get ready for the day by reading what Natasha has to say. And she's going to join us a little bit later in the program to talk about last night's elections and what impact it might have here. Also about how the governor's doing on the veto session. He had a big win in the House yesterday. Right now, Terry Savage is here. You can read more from her at terrysavage.com. And if you're a small business owner, there's a big column up there today that you should probably check out.
Okay, we ended the last section talking about people who find themselves priced out of insurance on the Obamacare exchange. That's going to be next week's column, and I'm going to show you how to go to a place like ehealthinsurance.com. I know I sound like a commercial for them, but they have emerged as the leading player so that you might take a one-year short-term insurance plan. There might be a high deductible plan if the exchange plans are both A, too expensive, and B, don't include doctors that you're already using and need to continue using. But here is something even more special for those of you who qualify.
Now, I want to give a little carnival barking for this one, because you brought this up last year.
Yep.
And started hearing from business owners who weren't expecting it, and it made a real impact on them. It changed their financial situation.
We got emails that were so amazing.
So if you are a business owner, listen to what Terry has to say. This is a real one.
If you're a business owner, there's like 25 million Americans who work for small businesses, and those businesses don't offer health insurance. I get that. It's a small business, and under the ordinary laws, the small business has to have contribute some money to the cost of the insurance. So right away the boss says, oh, I'm not making enough money as right. it is. And you go get yours on Obamacare. And number two, they have to have a certain percentage participating. So small businesses just say, I don't want to do this. Now there's a one-month period. It's called the Small Business Special Enrollment Period. It runs starting right away, November 15th through December 15th, for coverage starting in 2018. And these small businesses employing from one to no more than 50 people have this one-month opportunity to buy not just insurance, but the very best group insurance available at no cost to the business, and without any of those how many people participate requirements. It is a really neat thing. I want to give credit to Alan Wishner of the Insurance Shop website, SHOPPE, for turning me on to this last year. We generated a rush, so much of a rush, because my column is national now, that they made a few changes this year.
Really?
Yes. Okay. So the law says now, by the way, so the law says that this these small businesses that qualify must have a choice of the same fabulous insurance policies that any business in this area and town offers. In other words, broad choices of networks and doctors and types of plans where you could either get a high deductible plan or you could get a low deductible plan and copays and so forth. I mean, a chance to give your employees access to the best insurance. And you really only need two people working. Only one has to participate. So let's just say the owner is over 65 and gets Medicare, but you have a younger worker that needs insurance, actually makes too much to get an Obamacare subsidy and is going, oh my God, what do I have to spend for a policy? Now you can have that group plan even if you, the employer, or don't take it.
All right, go to terrysavage.com. You can read the column and it's explained there. I'm sure we'll touch base on it again before the month is
up. Here's the deal. You have to set it. If you have an existing company this year, they're going to make you show wage, W-2, and tax quarterly tax filings to show that this employee was on. But if it's a new company formed in 2017, like tomorrow, even if it's a partnership between a husband and wife and one of them takes the insurance, you only have to show 2 weeks of pay stubs. So the whole point, go to terrysavage.com, read this, because if you think you'd like to set up a small business and offer this coverage to the people who want to pay for it. By the way, the employees pay pre-tax. They deduct their premiums.
Oh, nice.
And they can have a health savings account so that they can pay pre-tax for all their copays and out-of-pockets.
All right, check it out, terrysavage.com. Terry, we'll see you next week.
Absolutely.
Happy Wednesday afternoon to you. It is very sunny out on Michigan Avenue as we sit here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. And it also looks a little like winter. People are pretty bundled up. I'm sure Frank Sennett, wherever he is incredibly bundled up right now. He joins us from Crane Chicago Business to talk about some of the stories that they've been writing about these days. Frank, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. That was a warm welcome, so I'm all cozy.
Are you under a blanket or anything like that? Do you have there was a time when when I was working early mornings here, when I had a blanket in my file drawer.
No, it's nice and warm here at the Cranes Building here at Randolph in Michigan. So come on by and warm up.
You know, we talk with Suzanne Muchin most Mondays about women in the workplace. Terry Savage was just here, who is has been a member, still is a member of several corporate boards. And I see the story by Claire Bushy about the number of women on corporate boards in, it's Fortune 1000 companies in Illinois, and the number looks incredibly low. And then I find out it's pretty much smack dab in the middle when it comes to the country as a whole.
Yeah, we've got a ways to go when it comes to adequate gender diversity at the board level, clearly. 19.5% of directors of Fortune 1000 companies in Illinois are women currently, according to the nonprofit 2020 Women on Boards. And as you say, that's kind of in the middle. The Half the states have fewer, and half the states have more. Washington State had the highest percentage of female board directors, but they only topped out at 24.6%.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
A lot of ways to go.
When you look at the number one state in the country, and it's still under a quarter, it's pretty remarkable. I don't know why this is. I mean, well, I know why this is, but why it's not coming back more quickly. And I'm assuming it's because there just isn't the corporate boards aren't turning over as fast as you might think. And if there was a faster turnover, there would be more women put into some of these positions. Is that a naive reading or is that your understanding too, Frank?
No, I think that's part of it. Part of it also is, you know, activist investors can get various things done with publicly held companies, and perhaps there hasn't been enough activist investor pressure on gender diversity or diversity overall on corporate boards. That could be one reason. Also, there's a talent pipeline, right, that you get to a certain point in your career as a leader, and then you're seen as board material.
Right.
Well, in Chicago, you know, only 8.1% of public companies are currently led by women in the C-suite. So that pipeline is smaller than it needs to be, and the result is once you get to that level of your career where you're asked to be on a board, they're looking around and the pipeline isn't full of women. So it's a systemic issue, I think, that goes all the way down.
As I said, Terry was here just in the first half hour, and I had hoped to talk to her about this, but we just didn't have time. But I said off the air, I said, you know, what do these board members actually do anyway? And her jaw dropped, and I thought she was going to, you know, throw daggers at me. She's like, well, they run the company, and I get all of that. But I also do have this feeling you mentioned sort of being board worthy. I have a feeling that there are a number of people who, you know, just sort of collect board spots. I'm not sure what the value is there. And I think that has more to do with my misunderstanding than reality.
Well, I mean, I think there's different levels of board engagement that you see. But, yeah, a good active board of directors will, you know, help select the leadership team, keep them in line, help set the strategic vision, help with compensation, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of interesting board governance issues, and boards you know, can be highly active. And in some companies, that's not the case, and they're less active, to your point.
That's my dream job. I just want to be appointed to boards and not really do anything. Caterpillar.
Send me a check, yeah.
What's that?
Just send me a check.
Exactly. Caterpillar added Kelly Ayotte, a recent senator from, I think it was New Hampshire, right, on their board this year. U.S. Ambassador Caroline Kennedy has joined the board of Boeing, fresh from her overseas post. But when it comes to companies in Illinois who've done well, Ulta Beauty's got 45%, 45.5% of their board members are women. That's not too bad.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That's close to where you want it to be.
And Abbott Laboratories at 36.4%. Now, if the Hall of Shame, I guess, three Illinois companies with no women on their boards are Distributor U.S. Foods, Hub Group, and the truck manufacturer out in the suburbs, Navistar. So there's that. A Story in Cranes by Claire Bushy. Okay.
And really a good taking of the pulse, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. And certainly not the last we'll hear about that. All right. John Fritchie had a news conference yesterday. I tried to talk to him myself on the phone, and our schedules didn't match up. But he's one of these guys. He was early on. He's a Cook County Board Commissioner now. As a state legislator, he was one of the early guys with medical marijuana. And he is going to, he says he's got enough support to put a referendum on the Cook County ballot next March to gauge our temperature for legalized marijuana. What are his arguments for this?
Well, first of all, did he hold his event at 4:20 p.m.?
No, it was in the morning. It was 9:30. What's he thinking?
It's always 4:20 somewhere, right?
Yeah, right.
I've known John for years, and he really is a thoughtful legislator at the county level. I think, you know, part of this is looking at probably trends around the country. We're seeing a lot more legalization initiatives at the state level, at the municipal and county level. And then also, I think, you know, if you're looking at the death of the soda pop tax and you're looking for other revenue sources on the one hand, and you're looking for needing to spend less on crime control, perhaps on the other hand, maybe legalizing marijuana and taxing it leads to, you know, less law enforcement expense and more tax revenue. I think it's maybe kind of a nifty solution to fill some of that hole from the soda tax being repealed.
Greg Hines wrote about it. He said, you know, in Colorado, where it's legal now, they picked up $193 million in tax revenue last year, And just through September this year, they're at 182 million. So they're going to do even better next year. It seems like it's probably not a bad source of tax revenue, I guess. But the other thing Hines points out, and I hadn't thought about this too much, but you know, it goes back. I was a big fan of Steve Martin in the 70s, and I had his albums, and he was doing a riff on San Francisco, and he's like, yeah, man, San Francisco, you smoke marijuana in San Francisco, you can get a ticket for that. That was really funny. Remember that? But that's kind of what it is now here in Chicago, and I guess statewide, you just get a ticket. I don't know how much that really clogs up the court systems or the jails if it's just minor possession.
Yeah, but if you look at yesterday, there was a big bust. It was a gang-related pot pipeline bust, and there was all over social media a picture of all the marijuana that was seized. If you think about the gang-related activity, when you make something like that illegal, like with Prohibition, with the Al Capone era, right, with the booze, there may not have been all that many convictions for running a speakeasy, but there was a lot of associated crime, and it did take a lot of police resources to deal with. And the same is true now. And not to say that, you know, it makes sense from a public policy perspective to legalize everything, but perhaps if you legalize pot and you tax it at a high level, you would get a salutary effect on crime-fighting expenditures.
You know,
fewer people getting in trouble.
That's a good point. And it's one of those issues where you just want to go up to the politicians, put your hand on their shoulder and say, look, it's going to happen. We all know it's going to happen. Let's just get going.
Yeah. But, you know, at the federal level, it still remains illegal, even in states such as Washington and Colorado, where it's been legalized. And, you know, there's been some noise from Attorney General Jeff Sessions that maybe they're going to prioritize again taking down pot to dispensaries and that kind of thing. There had been a move to, you know, it's not legal at the federal level, but to at least not be prioritizing rating these kinds of operations, kind of letting the states experiment. And so, you know, it remains an open question whether that's going to continue.
Well, Jeff Sessions was here. I'd put my hand on his shoulder and I'd say, Jeff, come on. It's going to. That might be the third or fourth thing I'd bring up. I don't know. All right. Frank Sennett at Crane Chicago Business. Read a lot more about this and more good news at chicagobusiness.com. Nice to talk to you, Frank.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, Natasha Krecki is on a phone line, and she's one of my favorite people, although we've only spoken once or twice before. Natasha, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I start my day with you most days with the Illinois Playbook that you write for Politico.com. Terry Savage was just in here in the first half hour, and she's a convert, too, so she'll be one of your followers by tomorrow.
Good to know.
And you guys go back to the Sun-Times, right?
That's right.
Okay, so yeah. I want to start with some of the things you've been writing about, but you're watching today as well. Is there anything that's gone on today in Springfield that we should know about?
Well, yeah, probably the good rest of the business is going to take place today for the veto session. There's going to be some more sexual harassment reform stuff that passes through. The Senate's going to take up this transparency bill that Susana Mendoza has been pushing. The House unanimously voted to override.
And that's the bill which says that the state has to be, they kind of have to publish how behind they are in bills or what they're not paying?
Right, right. Instead of doing it once a year, they'll have to do it far more frequently than that. So, that's probably a couple of the big ones there. Yesterday, of course, the major one was this right to work bill.
And so the governor, you know, doesn't have a lot of successes, I would argue, but this was certainly one of them, right? The fact that this veto was sustained. Explain for me what's going on with this right to work bill and why it's a win for Governor Rauner.
Well, it's a win for Governor Rauner. Rauner was successful in pushing this issue and advocating for local right to work zones in Illinois, and it's an issue that's going up before the Supreme Court. Now people are thinking with the reconstituted Supreme Court, it could mean that this issue is upheld and becomes law in Illinois. So what Democrats were trying to do was kind of circumvent this by doing their own local law that would say no matter what the Supreme Court does, this is not going to be legal here.
And so under the law, it would allow it would allow a town to say, we're going to be sort of a right-to-work zone within our city limits for our government contracts, and then workers could or could not work on those projects, right? Did I explain that correctly?
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right.
So it's a way to undermine the construction unions and things like that. That's a big win for the governor.
Right. That is what he, you know, he suffered some defeats yesterday, but I don't think he really cared. This is the one he really, he put all of his eggs in this basket. This is what he cared about. It failed by one vote. And that's it. I don't think they have any more chances on this one.
So, all right, so the political world was watching Virginia yesterday, too. A big governor's race, a contested race, where the Democrat was kind of favored to win early on, but then things got tight. The Democrats were scared to death, but always it was going to be a 2 or 3 point race. It ended up he won by 9 percentage points, a real blowout, and one of many for the Democrats yesterday. Do you think they're paying attention to that in the governor's office today in Springfield?
Yeah, I think it's making them very nervous. If you're a Republican in any blue state or even purple state, you're nervous right now. You're watching. Of course, you know, these states are all different, but...
But Natasha, the Republicans, I mean, there have been a number of these elections coming up to this one, and the Republicans have all done pretty well. Why is this one more frightening for the Republicans than the others were for the Democrats?
Well, this one is because it really was, you know... It was really getting this reputation of being, and the exit polls ended up showing this, is this a message to Trump? You know, is this just a gubernatorial election, or is this a message to Trump? And what was scariest, I think, for Republicans here is that in the past, the suburban voters have come out in favor of Republicans, or it's been, a tight race there. In this case in Virginia, overwhelmingly Democrats came out in the suburbs. They rejected the Republican and they went for Trump. And that's what scares Republicans everywhere, and especially in Illinois, because that is what is seen as the real battleground in 2018 is the suburbs.
All right, we've got 20 seconds left, and I'm going to carry that then to the tax writing bill, because one of the things that, you know, that's in the Republican bill is this elimination of the exemption for state and local taxes. So if you look at the Republican, the collar counties, the suburban counties swinging toward the Democrats, how do Republican congressmen from those same collar counties or swing suburban counties vote to take away that key sort of benefit? I'm thinking about Peter Roskam. Roskam helped write this bill, so I'm sure he's a yes. But guys like Roskam, I would think, are going to look at this a second time.
I think you're right. I mean, it changes the lens from which they're looking through, especially if they're trying to appeal to suburban voters. That's something that people are going to hold on to for 2018.
Natasha Kurecki, great to talk to you. People, check it out. It's the Illinois Playbook at Politico. I hope we can talk again soon.
I do, too. Thank you.